Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about meditation keeps emotional brain in check from Michigan State University and how a pine bark extract can curb how your muscles age. And from Georgia State University, how resveratrol, that's from grapes, can help to reduce inflammation in all areas of the body. And a very interesting study from UCLA, published in the peer-reviewed journal Aging, epigenetic clock predicts life expectancy. And then from University of California, moderate alcohol, small amounts of alcohol, is linked to heart chamber damage, atrial fibrillation. That's really bad. And the Mediterranean diet could lower the risk of cardiovascular disease, University of Cambridge, and more. From our environmental segment today, the U.S. drives rainforest destruction by importing Amazonian oil. This is a report that we should all know about because it's something we can do something about. And then we're going to look at science in crisis, from the sugar scam to Brexit. Our faith in experts is fading. According to this study, there are almost 2 million papers published a year in roughly 30,000 different journals. But according to these experts, more than 50% cannot be trusted. Quote, they will not stand the test of time. So a lot of people are controlling the outcome of the science, and almost all of them have a profit motive. Also today, something we were not told, something that shows the FBI broke the law, as did the U.S. attorney. I'll read it to you. Have you ever heard of the United States Code? It's the law. And this was in Cornell Law Library. And you'll see when I read this, you'll say, wow, that's about Hillary Clinton, what she did. It's not gray at all. It's very black and white. Also today, from our audio file, we're going to have an extended look inside the Palestinian territories to better understand the conflict, the history of the conflict. Because right now it doesn't look like anything is being done to resolve this peacefully for both the Jewish people, who deserve to live in peace and harmony, and the Palestinian people. There is no reason not to have a two-state solution. The current government does not want that. And so from Abby Martin, we'll look at the Palestinian-Israeli issue. And we'll look at some other audio clips also today. We're going to look at how, when it comes to other people's countries, the United States is by no means an innocent bystander. And also, Saudi Arabia is terrified of release of the 20 pages. Now it's been released. Now the Senate has passed a unanimous override, 99-1, in favor of allowing those who feel that they were victims of 9/11 to sue Saudi Arabia and other countries. What does that mean? What is the likely pushback from Saudi Arabia? Why is this president supported not having this law? I'll get into all that. As you see, we have a lot to share today, so let's begin. I advocate meditation a great deal because I see how in almost every situation it helps people to relax. It helps people to chill out. It helps people just to be calm, lower their blood pressure, lower their cholesterol, better digestion, better sleep, all comes from being more meditative. This is from Michigan State University, published in the Frontiers in Human Neuroscience. They found that you can help tame those emotions you don't like if you're a mindful person, but if you're not mindful, you cannot tame them. Reporting in the Journal of Frontiers in Human Neuroscience, psychology researchers recorded the brain activity of people looking at disturbing pictures immediately after meditating for the first time, and these participants were able to tame their negative emotions just as well as participants who were naturally mindful. Quote, our findings not only demonstrate that meditation improves emotional health, but the people can acquire these benefits regardless of their natural ability to be mindful. It just takes practice. Well, how can we use this in everyday? It's relatively simple. We are all faced with things we don't want to see, stories we don't want to hear. It's one of the reasons I believe that the left has been remiss in trying to make change. If all you do is to show the consequences of bad actions, if you show, you know, the fields of battle, if you show the dismembered, the destroyed, all of the destruction of war, that can traumatize people to the point where they don't want to hear about it. They feel overwhelmed. When we see big catastrophes, when we see hurricanes and typhoons and volcanoes and massive desert of dry or torrential rain like in Louisiana, we feel incompatible with the solution. We're just one person, and it's just too much, and it overloads people's sensory apparatus, and as a result, they just withdraw and detach. I think it's much more constructive if we were to approach showing what is the actual cause of this problem and what are some of the solutions that I as an individual, as well as we as a group, could participate in. I think that people are more open to that, and it's more likely you're going to get people then engaged in a constructive way of making positive change. So if you're mindful, meaning if you're present in the moment, you process information as just that, information. What you choose to do with that information is based upon how informed you are, how self-empowered you are. Otherwise, you're going to personalize everything. You're going to go off the charts emotionally. You're going to get angry. You're going to get defensive. You're going to become rageful or jealous. You're going to become envious. And this is what we see every day playing out. Just look at the debates. It was so obvious that that Clinton was going to bait Donald Trump, and he is so immature that he took it and ran with it because it wasn't about being objective and looking at the information. It was about defending his ego. That's not the kind of person you want in a position of power. But people in power almost always, first and foremost, defend their ego. Not just people running for the President of the United States. What do you think happens every day to generals, in the armed forces, who have enormous power? You never see the fault going up to them. It always stops with someone who has less power. And in corporations where people on boards of directors and CEOs make bad choices, and then when the company doesn't do well, they never fire themselves. They never apologize and say, I'm going to give back all my money. Instead, they fire people who had nothing to do with the choice. That's how we process. Those are people who are never mindful, but they're always diligent, like a radar sweeping from their subconscious the epigenetic of dysfunction. So mindful meditation helps you disconnect from your reactive reptilian conditioned brain and simply be present to look at the world for what it is and therefore to see what you could do about it. Because once you are skilled enough to do something, you can be a positive solution. It's no different. Let's say you had 100 people and someone suddenly cuts a vein and blood is spurting everywhere. Most people are going to scream and yell and not know what to do and look helpless. Let's say you were trained as a nurse or emergency service or a physician. You could go over and you could stanch that bleeding. You would have to be focused. You're trained. You know what to do. So the person that is trained in solving a problem is the person who's going to stay most calm in that crisis. And we lose our composure. We lose our emotion. We lose our spiritual equilibrium when we overreact. So that's the takeaway message. A spice of life that can cool your stomach. Well, that spice, according to science reports, is cinnamon. Adding cinnamon to your diet can cool your body by up to 2 degrees and the spice may also contribute to the general improvement of your good health. We know it enhances digestion. We know it is an anti, excessive gastric acid. We know that it can protect the walls of your stomach. So it is a very important nutrient, and if you're diabetic, it helps maintain blood sugar levels. So cinnamon, it's a cool herb. And from Georgia State University, resveratrol, which is the nutrient in grapes, and also in some berries, according to this study, can help turn down inflammation by a bacterial pathogen that is linked to upper respiratory tract inflammation, diseases like asthma and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and middle ear infection like otitis media. That's according to this study. Now think of the millions upon millions of Americans suffering from asthma, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and inner ear infections. And resveratrol can make a big difference. Quote, we show that an important component in red wine and also grapes called resveratrol can suppress inflammation. Good. And another study from D'Annunzio University in Italy showed that pine bark extract, that's your pycnogenol, can help curb age-related muscle loss. Quote, supplementing from the French maritime pine bark, pycnogenol may help stabilize muscle loss, support musculature function, and boost daily muscle endurance. And that was published in a peer-reviewed literature also. And I'm going to spend a little more time on this. This is from UCLA, and it's an article entitled Epigenetic Clock Predicts Life Expectancy. This was a big study. 65 scientists from 7 countries engaged in aging research came together to study the human DNA, and they did something that I first talked to you about 40 years ago on the radio, that you have two ages, your biological age, but more importantly, your chronological age. And by traveling around the world and studying other cultures, I showed that we are actually older chronologically than biologically by almost double. So if you're 60, really 120, and biologically there's no reason you can't live to be about 140. So when people hit 70, they're actually middle-aged if they've lived a good life. That's why you can say the new 60 is 40 and the new 50 is 30. It depends upon how you've lived. Here's what they said, quote, our research reveals valuable clues into what causes human aging, marking a first step towards developing targeted methods to slow the process. That's according to the professor of human genetics and biostatistics, UCLA School of Medicine. They drew upon 13 sets of data, including the landmark Framingham Heart Study and the Women's Health Initiative, and looked at 25 different institutions that analyzed DNA and blood samples collected from 13,000 people, and then applying a variety of molecular methods, including what is called the epigenetic clock, developed by Professor Horvath in 2013, the scientists measured the aging rates of each individual. Now, the clock calculates the aging of blood and other tissues by tracking methylation. Now, you've heard me mention many, many times methylation. That's a natural process that chemically alters your DNA over time. And by comparing chronological age to the biological blood's age, the scientists used the clock to predict each person's life expectancy. Quote, we were stunned to see that the epigenetic clock was able to predict the lifespans of Caucasians, Hispanics, and African Americans. And this rang true even after adjusting for traditional risk factors like age, gender, smoking, fat content, which is body mass index, disease history, and blood cell counts. So here's the takeaway message, and this is where I spent my entire adult career. And the evidence, the latest evidence, is something that no one's done, but we just did. We did a 3-month study, starting with 500 people, and watched to see how we could change the aging process, which is lifestyle and behavior modification, focusing upon repairing the DNA. in effect, taking an older DNA and making it young again, extending the lifespan of telomeres, lengthening the telomeres instead of shortening them. Shorter the telomere, faster you die. And this is where people were asked to give up all sugar, all artificial sweeteners and coffee and colas, meats of all kinds, including fish and eggs, vegan only, no wheat, no GMOs, and certain supplements, lots of juicing, lots of enzymes, lots of probiotics, lots of fermented food, exercising and stress management. And by doing that, people, even though we were not treating any disease, people who had asthma gone, depression gone, anxiety gone. In fact, on Saturday, a woman came up to me and said, for 22 years, I've had all kinds of problems with my legs and with pains and shooting pains. I have not had a pain since the second week in this study when I gave up everything. And another person overcame diabetes. Many overcame diabetes. Hair was growing, skin was tightening and becoming younger, nails growing strong and pink, a libido returning, better sleep, more energy. And this was in a large group. So I'm submitting it now. It has been submitted to an outside scientific statistician who will do the statistics, and then I'll send the article out to some peer-reviewed journal and then present it at some international conference on aging, which I do on a regular basis from our studies. That's what you have to do. And what they're saying is methylation is the key, but they didn't tell you anything more. They simply found the phenomena. How many times have you heard me say, take a plump chicken, moist and soft, put it in an oven, take it out, 2 hours later, it's crisp and brown. That is where you are changing the methylation process. You're creating these advanced glycation-aged products. That's what happens when you eat animal protein or sugar. You simply create these glycated molecular products in the body. That ages you prematurely. That makes you older than what you are biologically. Now, it's deceptive because you can keep pretty much the same weight. You can even go out and do a little exercise. You can occasionally take your vitamins or take a vitamin C each day like the average person does. But this is all extremely superficial. This is like seeing a raging fire where your house is literally burning down and you say, well, thank goodness, you know, I'm prepared. I've been living rather consciously. And you go over and you get a 1 gallon bucket of water and you go over and you throw it on a gigantic fire. And it does absolutely nothing. So this game of moderation works always against us. Moderation in all things is good. No, it's terrible. Because something as toxic is still toxic, even if it's in parts per trillions or billions, it just takes a little longer before it manifests its symptoms. But by the time you have the symptoms, you're already well on your way to being in an advanced aged state. Now, one of the biggest killers of all, one of the fastest way of aging your cells and destroying your DNA and shortening your telomeres, one of the fastest way of putting methylation in your body, stress. Now, it doesn't matter what the stress is from. It could be because you're unemployed, because you're underemployed, because you've got a bad relationship. It could be because you have no relationship. It could be because you're living in the wrong place, because you're suddenly out of a place you were living. 1,000 different excuses. But your body's still going to react as if it was all the same. It's a flight or fight response. And we're turning it on like a 5-alarm fire, and we're living it on 24/7. And you can knock about 15 years, in my opinion, off your lifespan if you're chronically stressed or lonely or depressed or anxious. Now, the lifespan is already being reduced. For the first time in more than 50 years, the lifespan is coming backwards. Not good. And especially so, it's accelerating backwards in women. And we've gone through this many times, the stress today, doing too much today, not being in really supportive and unconditionally loving relationships today. And you pay a price for it. So that's what they're finding. So thank goodness, finally, after 40 years, they're beginning to at least acknowledge what some of us have been knowing for our entire careers, that every single choice you make in your life, no matter how insignificant it may seem, you'll pay a price for, because your DNA is altered. And that's why when I'm telling people, have your most powerful meal of the day must be breakfast, and it ideally should be a smoothie. And in that smoothie, you flood the body with phytonutrients, with all your green vegetables and your red fruits and your grapes and your nuts and your plant-based protein. Everything in there should be meant to repair the DNA, to create new mitochondria, your energy cells, to detoxify and cleanse the body and its systems, the enzymes to stimulate proper digestion, absorption, elimination. So that's what we should do. Now you go around the country and you look at what the average person eats. And then you think, my goodness, every day it's the same. And none of it is healthy. I mean, nothing Americans are doing is healthy right now. If you're 90% of the American population, multiple things you do every day actually increase the impact of methylation upon the body, which, according to this study from the largest study of its kind in the world, shows you're going to die sooner. That your biological age is what's killing you. Your chronological age is of no relevance at all. So when someone says age doesn't matter, the chronological age does not matter. Your biological age does matter. I'm Gary Nall. That's the latest on health and healing. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. In just about 5 minutes, we're going to listen to Abby Martin talk about her experiences and her reality at looking up close in Palestine, at the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. I know that there can be a two-state solution. I know that peace and harmony, which both groups of people deserve, the Jewish people deserve to live in peace and harmony, Palestinians deserve to live in freedom, peace, and harmony. But that's not what our current leaders, nor those in Israel, but there are a lot of people in Israel who do want a change. They're just not in power. I want to play a short clip for you about when it comes to other people's wars, other countries' wars, the United States is by no means an innocent bystander. Listen in, I think you'll find this interesting.
At the UN General Assembly this week, the U.S. and Russia pointed fingers at one another for the devastating war in Syria and the resulting refugee crisis. Obama took a subtle jab at Putin's defense of the Syrian government, saying,
in accordance with this logic, we should support tyrants like Bashar al-Assad, who drops barrel bombs to massacre innocent children, because the alternative is surely worse.
Obama's kind of right about Russia. The country has sent tanks and aircraft, as well as military advisors, to beef up Assad's defenses. But the U.S. is by no means an innocent bystander. Weapons the U.S. supplied to rebel opposition groups in Syria have inadvertently ended up in the hands of al-Qaeda. And in Iraq, weapons meant for the Iraqi army ended up in the hands of ISIS. In fact, the U.S. happens to be the biggest arms supplier in the world. The U.S. has supplied countries like Israel, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt with complex weapon systems, even as their governments have been blamed for committing human rights abuses with those weapons. The thing is, the weapons industry is big business, worth $85 billion worldwide. U.S. companies, including Lockheed Martin and Boeing, sold more than $23.7 billion in arms last year to nearly 100 different countries. And arms exports have actually increased under Obama by 23%, the most of any administration since World War II. The majority of U.S. weapons exports end up in Asia and Oceania, although the Middle East received 32% of all exports in 2014. And because domestic sales have declined in recent years, U.S. companies have all the more reason to look abroad. Earlier this year, Lockheed Martin CEO Marilyn Hewson said that the company is looking at the, quote, volatility in both the Middle East and Asia Pacific as a way to increase their sales internationally.
In both of those regions, which are growth areas for us, we expect that there's going to continue to be opportunities for us to bring our capabilities to them.
In other words, the more war, the more profit. Now, Congress does control the export of U.S.-made weapons, but the defense industry keeps Congress on their side with $150 million in campaign contributions and lobbying last year alone. Pope Francis even called out the U.S. during a recent speech to Congress. He said the reason deadly weapons are being sold to groups and governments around the world is simply for money.
Money that is drenched in blood, often innocent blood.
So is the business of war worth the profit when you consider the human cost?
Now, this is something interesting because here is President Obama challenging Putin. And if it weren't for Putin, none of the 12 to 14,000 oil tankers that were going from Turkey into Syria and into Iraq, stealing their oil, bringing it back across Turkey's border, then shipping it out to Israel and other countries on the black market for around $20 a barrel, big savings for people wanting to get black market oil, and that was funding ISIS and other terrorist groups. Never once in 14 months did Obama bomb a single one of those tankers, even though at times, if you have 12,000 tankers back-to-back, you're looking at miles upon miles upon miles, and you can see them with satellites. And since we have reconnaissance nonstop 24/7, from 17 different intelligence agencies in the United States alone, we knew everything they were doing. But what the American public doesn't know is how the United States armed up Syrian jihadists. Now, it's really irrelevant whether it is called al-Nusra or ISIS. It's still a terrorist. These people are generally, more often than not, they're either mercenaries who do not have a religious core or who are religious the jihadists who generally come from the most radical form of Sunniism. Not all Sunni believers are Wahhabists. That is a special, very, very destructive form of religious intolerance out of Saudi Arabia, and those are the ones who are leading a lot of this. So on the one hand, the United States ships those arms to Qatar, to Saudi Arabia, and then they arm the jihadists and then take them into Syria or Libya or anywhere else they want. But we never criticize them for this. Why? Because the United States, according to the latest research by Alastair Crook from Consortium News, we're the ones arming them and training them also. In fact, we're arming both sides, not the Syrian. We're arming the dissidents, but we're also arming the most rabid, radical, head-chopping Islamicist in Syria. Quote, this is an interesting report here. It says, and this was the story of the U.S. Special Forces under one presidential authority arming Syria anti-ISIS forces, while the CIA, obsessed with overthrowing President Bashar Assad and operating under a separate presidential authority, conducted a separate and parallel program to arm the anti-Assad insurgents, those the terrorists. Quote, Murphy's report makes clear the CIA disdain for combating ISIS, and but the person behind that is the person running the CIA, and this was his private, kind of effort. So there we are. We're arming the terrorists, plain and simple, and everyone knows it. So how can you condemn Russia for coming in and helping Assad, and had Russia not intervened and destroyed much of ISIS and al-Nusra, but also stopped the oil from going back and forth, then by this time, even a year ago, Assad would have been destroyed, and his once prosperous nation would be in the hands today of Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and ISIS. And it would just be a bloodbath, as it is in Libya. In fact, in an interview with Jürgen Todtenholder, first published in Germany, it says that an interview with al-Nusra commander, quote, "The Americans stand on our side." This is the terrorist saying this. It was the seventh trip that I had made into civil war in Syria. We were there 13 days. And by the way, they had to have the ability to go through al-Nusra territory to meet with the commander of al-Qaeda and Abu al-Izzi. And he says, quote, reported quite openly about his financiers, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Kuwait, who were able to exactly research the identity of the man and know practically everything about him, says that then he went into Aleppo and says that they have been, the United States has been funding with special weapons and trainers on the ground in other countries, and then sending them into that country. Quote, this is a commander. This is a Al-Qaeda commander. Says, quote, we are one part of Al-Qaeda. And then goes into his principles. And he says, our affairs and others have changed. Israel, for example, is now supporting us because Israel is at war with Syria and with Hezbollah. America also is changing about us. Originally, ICE and us were one group, but ICE was used in the interests of big states like America for political reasons and was steered away from our principles. It became clear to us that most of their leaders work with secret security services. We, al-Nusra, have our own way. In the past, they were with us, and they were our supporters. Then he goes on to talk about how America supports all of the terrorist groups. So here we are, talking about terrorism, and yet none of the media want to point out the obvious. They don't want to send their reporters there and get the actual firsthand story. We, the United States, are financing, equipping al-Nusra, and sending weapons to countries that directly support ISIS, including Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Qatar, United Arab Emirates. It's just utter hypocrisy. Now, this is also hypocritical. When you and I commit a crime, we are held accountable as if there's just one set of laws. I'm going to read you verbatim from the Cornell Law Library what the U.S. Code says, quote, whoever willfully and unlawfully conceals, removes, mutilates, obliterates, or destroys, or attempts to do so, or with intent to do, takes and carries away any record, proceeding, map, book, paper, document, or other thing filed or deposited with any clerk or officer of any court in the United States or in any public office or with any judicial or public officer of the United States shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 3 years or both. B, whoever having the custody of any such record, proceeding, map, book, document, paper, or other thing, willfully or unwillfully, conceals, removes, mutilates, obliterates, falsifies, or destroys the same, shall be fined under this title of or imprisoned not more than 3 years or both, and shall forfeit his office and be disqualified from holding any office under the United States. As used in this subsection, the term office does not include the office held by any person as a retired officer of the Armed Forces of the United States, end quote. Now that's exactly, explicitly saying, quote, shall forfeit his office and be disqualified from holding any office under the United States. Hillary Clinton did exactly that. She concealed in official documents on her personal computer and off premises. She violated this completely. If I can give you this from Cornell Law Library, and this is exactly the U.S. law, it's the U.S. Code, then why can't the FBI or Justice Department find Hillary Clinton guilty, in which case she would not be allowed to run for president and she would be in jail? And now, in this political season, let's hear from George Carlin deciphering hidden political language.
established my press credentials. And because you and I have at least one thing in common, which is that all of us deal with language all the time, I thought it might be nice today for me to come to you with some of my language complaints. Certainly not to blame them on you, although, of course, you are implicated. And not that you can help it. I mean, the problem is really with the people you cover, the politicians, the celebrities, and the lawyers. And although their level of insincerity is astonishing, it's still kind of fun to hear them talk. In particular, it's fun to listen to Washington talk. Whenever the issue of term limits comes up, I always tell people the only term limits I'm interested in would be to limit some of the terms used by politicians. They speak, of course, with great caution because they must take care not to actually say anything. Proof of this, according to their own words, is that they don't actually say things, they indicate them. As I indicated yesterday, and as the president indicated to me, but sometimes they don't indicate, they suggest. Let me suggest that as I indicated yesterday, I haven't determined that yet. See, they don't decide, they determine. If it's a really serious matter, they make a judgment. I haven't made a judgment on that yet. When the hearings are concluded, I will make a judgment, or I might make an assessment. I'm not sure. I haven't determined that yet. But when I do, I will advise you. They don't tell, they advise. I advised him that I had made a judgment. Thus far, he hasn't responded. They don't answer, they respond. He hasn't responded to my initiative. An initiative is an idea that isn't going anywhere. When he responds to my initiative, I will review his response, take a position, and make a recommendation. See, they don't read, they review, they don't have opinions, they take positions, and they don't give advice, they make recommendations. And so, at long last, after each has responded to the other's initiatives, and each has reviewed the other's responses, and everyone has taken a position, made a judgment, and offered a recommendation, now they have to do something. But that would be much too direct. So instead, they address the problem. We're addressing the problem, and we'll soon be proceeding. That's a big activity here in Washington. Proceeding. They're always proceeding or moving forward. A lot of that goes on. Senator, have you solved that problem? Well, we're moving forward on that. And when they're not moving forward, they're moving something else forward, such as the process. We have to move the process forward so we can implement the provisions of the initiative in order to meet these challenges. No one has problems anymore. Challenges. That's why we need people who can make the tough decisions. Tough decisions like how much soft money can I expect to collect in exchange for my core values? So that... so that I can continue my work in government. Of course, no politician would admit to such a lowly station as working in government, serving the nation. I'm serving the nation. Another favorite distortion is public service. I'm in public service. I like America, don't you? The food is great, but the public service is terrible. Now, folks, a question for you. Do you think it's possible that one of these politicians, whose judgment is so poor that he honestly thinks of himself as serving the nation, might occasionally be expected to indulge in a little patriotism? Huh? What do you think? Well, of course, not only is it possible, it's inevitable, and that's when he's at his very best. That's when he trots out the really good stuff all across this great land of ours. The greatest nation on earth, the greatest nation in the history of the world. And in times of military crisis, you can be sure that someone in a suit in this town will eventually plant himself in front of a camera and carry on a great deal about the most powerful nation on the face of the earth. Now, normally, during peacetime, the politicians will refer to people in the military as our young men and women stationed around the world. But in wartime, they quickly become our brave young fighting men and women stationed halfway around the world in places whose names they can't pronounce, wondering if they'll ever see their loved ones again. For added emotional impact, sons and daughters can always be substituted for men and women. And so I think we can sum this up by saying that where the military is concerned, the extent of a politician's insincerity can be measured by how far around the world our soldiers are stationed and whether or not any of them can pronounce it. Incidentally, another way of expressing this sentiment is to say we're sending our young men and women to places the average American can't find on a map. I've always thought it was kind of funny and somewhat out of character for a politician to go out of his way to point out the low level of American intelligence when indeed his very job depends upon it. It would seem to fly in the face of that other rhetorical standby of theirs, the American people are a lot smarter than they're given credit for. This is said with a straight face, although it is obvious, of course, that the proposition is being stated precisely backwards. But the politicians, God bless them, or something like that, they're at their most entertaining when they're in trouble. When they're in trouble, their explanations usually begin simply with words like miscommunication. What did you do wrong, Senator? Well, it was a miscommunication. Or I was quoted out of context. Better yet, and more ironic, they twisted my words. Such a nice touch. A person who routinely spends his days torturing the language complains, they twisted my words. Then, as the controversy continues to heat up, he moves to his next level of complaint. The whole thing has been blown out of proportion. It's always the whole thing. Apparently, no one has ever claimed that only a small portion of something was blown out of proportion. Has to be the whole thing. That's because now he's feeling the heat. And so, as time passes and more evidence comes in, he suddenly changes directions and tells us, we're trying to get to the bottom of this. Now he's on the side of law and order. Jiu-jitsu, really. We're trying to get to the bottom of this so we can get the facts out to the American people. That's always a nice touch, American people. In fact, at this point, he might even say, I'm willing to trust in the fairness of the American people. Clearly, he's preparing us for something. And so, when finally all the facts come out and our subject seems quite guilty, he employs that sublime use of the passive voice, mistakes were made. Mistakes were made. Don't look at me. Probably someone in my office. Things are moving faster now. Mistakes were made is rapidly overtaken by there is no evidence. No one has proven anything. Eventually, I will be exonerated. I have faith in the American judicial system. And that certain sign that things are closing in, whatever happened to innocent until proven guilty? Whatever happened? Well, now, yeah. Well, he's about to find out. And we know this must be true because the next thing we hear from him is, I just want to put this thing behind me and get on with my life. I just want to put this behind me. That's an expression we hear a lot these days in all walks of life. From people in all walks of life, usually the person in question has committed some unspeakable act. Yes, it's true, I strangled my wife, shot the triplets, set fire to the house, and sold my young son to an old man on the train. But now I just want to put this thing behind me. Get on with it. That's the problem in this country. Too many people getting on with their lives. I think what we really need more of is ritual suicide. You know, never mind the press conferences. Get the big knife out of the drawer. Personally, what I want to do is to put this, I want to put this thing behind me and get on with my life. Thing behind me and get on with my life. I'll repeat that for you. Personally, I want to put this thing behind me and get on with my life. Thing behind me and get on with my life. And just to round out this section, let's hope there's a special place in hell reserved for those who have recently decided to take responsibility for their actions. That's the big thing now, taking responsibility for your actions, like it's a recent discovery. You know, he's taking responsibility for his actions. Well, isn't that wonderful? Ask him if he's willing to take responsibility for my actions, along with my alimony, my car payments, and my gambling debts.
That was George Carlin. Now, all of us are supposed to be fiscally responsible, especially those who are working middle class, the professional class, who have seen a lot of their savings dissipated, yet the cost of living and maintaining the lifestyle they had been privileged to have for a number of years or decades diminished. So what do you think when one single group of people called the Federal Reserve cannot find some money. And that also goes for the Department of Defense and the Department of the Army. We're talking about trillions of dollars. Well, one of our diligent legislators, Alan Grayson, challenged them under oath. I think this is an interesting exchange.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Inspector Coleman, you're the Inspector General for the Federal Reserve, right?
Okay. That's correct.
Have you done any investigations concerning the Federal Reserve's role in deciding not to save Lehman Brothers, which led to shockwaves that went through the entire financial system?
In that particular area, you know, I don't generally comment on specific investigations, but we do not currently have an investigation in that particular area.
All right. What about the $1 trillion plus an expansion of the Federal Reserve's balance sheet since last September? Have you conducted any investigations regarding that?
We call it a review, and I don't know if the term investigation may have different connotations. So we're actually conducting a fairly high-level review of the various lending facilities collectively, which would include the TALF, a variety of the different programs that are in process. So we're looking at them at a fairly high level to identify risk.
Well, I understand that, but we're talking about events that started unfolding 8 months ago. Have you reached any conclusions about the Fed expanding its balance sheet by over $1 trillion since last September?
We have not yet reached any conclusions.
Do you know who received that money?
We're in the process right now of doing our review and
Right, but you're the Inspector General. My question to you specifically is, do you know who received that $1 trillion plus that the Fed extended and put on its balance sheet since last September? Do you know the identity of the recipients?
I do not know. We have not looked at that specific area at this particular point on those reviews.
What about Bloomberg's report that there are trillions of dollars in off-balance sheets transactions that the Federal Reserve has entered into since last September? Are you familiar with those off-balance sheet transactions?
You know, I think it may be important at this point, too, just to bring up a certain aspect related to our jurisdiction. And just to clarify perhaps some of my earlier comments, we are the Inspector General for the Board of Governors, and we have direct oversight over board programs and operations, and are also able to look at board-delegated functions to the Reserve Banks, as well as the board's oversight and supervision of the Reserve Banks. We do not have jurisdiction to directly go out and audit Reserve Bank activities specifically. Nevertheless, in our lending facilities project, for example, we are looking at the board's oversight over the program and to the extent that extends out to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York.
Well, I have a copy of the Inspector General Act here in front of me, and it says, among other things, that it's your responsibility to conduct and supervise audits and investigations relating to the programs and operations of your agency.
That's correct.
So I'm asking you, if your agency has, in fact, according to Bloomberg, extended $9 trillion in credit, which, by the way, works out to $30,000 for every single man, woman, and child in this country, I'd like to know, if you're not responsible for investigating that, who is?
We have responsibility for the Federal Reserve's programs and operations audits, to conduct audits and investigations in that area. In terms of who's responsible for investigating, would you mind repeating the question one more time?
What have you done to investigate the off-balance sheet transactions conducted by the Federal Reserve, which according to Bloomberg now total $9 trillion in the last 8 months?
I'll have to look specifically at that Bloomberg article. I don't know if I have actually seen that particular one.
That's not the point. The question is, have you done any investigation or auditing of off-balance sheet transactions conducted by the Federal Reserve?
At this point, we're conducting our lending facility project at a fairly high level and have not gotten to a specific level of detail to really be in a position to respond to your question.
Have you conducted any investigation or auditing of the losses that the Federal Reserve has experienced on its lending since last September?
we're still in the process of conducting that review. Until we actually, you know, go out and gather the information, I'm not in a position to really respond to the specific question.
So are you telling me that nobody at the Federal Reserve is keeping track on a regular basis of the losses that it incurs on what is now a $2 trillion portfolio?
I don't know if you're telling me that you're mentioning that there's losses. I'm just saying that we're not, until we actually look at the program and have the information, we are not in a position to say whether there are losses or to respond in any other way to that particular.
Mr. Chairman, my time is up, but I have to tell you honestly, I am shocked to find out that nobody at the Federal Reserve, including the Inspector General, is keeping track of this.
Okay, so there you have it. The Federal Reserve, which is not a federal agency, but rather a central bank that, in effect, creates the money supply, creates the debt, establishes the interest rates, and as a result has enormous undue influence over our economy, they can't account for these trillions of dollars. It's just mind-blowing. That's just the Federal Reserve. Then there was another $6 trillion that Rumsfeld said was missing or unaccounted for at the Defense Department. Then there was another $2 to $3 trillion unaccounted for in the Department of Army. That's like $15, $16 trillion. And yet we're paying our taxes to support this nonsense. Let's take a look now at a report on Saudi Arabia and why they were afraid of the release of the 28 pages, then I'll give you a commentary about the likely outcome now that both the Senate and the House unanimously, in the case of the Senate, it was 96 to 1 and 2 abstentions, voted to override the president's veto, and it was about, it was, I think, 70-some no votes, but the rest were yes votes to override it in the House. So now you're going to see a whole lot of lawsuits against Saudi Arabia, and I'll tell you the likely outcome after you hear this.
Well, Saudi Arabia is threatening to sell off nearly $1 trillion in U.S. assets if Congress passes a bill that allows their country to be held liable in the September 11th attacks. What's the story really about, and is this threat even real? This is a reality check you won't see anywhere else. Well, Saudi Arabia has warned the Obama administration and members of Congress that it will sell off some $750 billion in U.S. Treasury bonds if Congress passes a bill that would allow Saudi officials to be held legally responsible for the 9/11 attacks. The Saudi foreign minister claims that the kingdom would be forced to sell up to $750 billion in those Treasury securities and other assets before the United States could freeze those assets in American courts. So what are the Saudis even concerned about? Well, it's actually one section of a report from the 9/11 report called the 28 pages. 28 pages that have been classified, and yet according to members of Congress in both parties and the heads of the 9/11 Commission, those 28 pages, if released to the public, will completely change everything you think you know about the 9/11 attacks. In one of those redacted sections of the 28 pages are the transfer of some $130,000 from then Saudi ambassador Prince Bandar's family checking account to one of the hijackers' Saudi handlers in San Diego. Also, members of the Saudi royal family living in Florida reportedly provided financial assistance to several of the 9/11 hijackers and then fled the country only days before the attacks. In fact, they left everything behind in their Florida home, including all of their clothing. In addition, the FBI evacuated dozens of Saudi officials from multiple cities, including at least one Osama bin Laden family member on the terror watch list. Instead of interrogating the Saudis, FBI agents acted as security escorts for them, even though it was known at the time that 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi citizens. So what would exactly this legislation do? Well, according to the New York Times, the Senate bill was intended to make clear that the immunity given to foreign nations under the law should not apply in cases where nations are found culpable for terrorist attacks that kill Americans on United States soil. If the bill were to pass both houses of Congress and be signed by the president, it could clear a path for the role of the Saudi government to be examined in the September 11th lawsuits. Well, so far, the Obama administration has been lobbying to block the passage of this law, including warning that its passage would threaten the lives of Americans overseas. But the truth? In the last two decades, millions of Americans have come to realize that the American relationship with Saudi Arabia is beyond troubling. So what you need to know is that the Saudis are panicking. But could they really sell off $750 billion in U.S. assets? Honestly, that's not very likely. Could they really harm the U.S. economy? Yes, they absolutely could. And do the Saudis protect the U.S. dollar in OPEC as the currency that all oil was bought and sold in? It's called the petrodollar. That's also absolutely true. Changing that could collapse much of our economy. But the bottom line here, for too long, the United States has been in a relationship with the Saudis that is beyond troubling. And the facts here, this relationship, as it stands, will eventually have to end. Because threatening to harm or trying to destroy our economy, if we pass a bill, well, wouldn't that be called terrorism if the group making that threat were any other Arab nation than Saudi Arabia?
Okay, now here are some thoughts. I believe that Saudi Arabia will play bluff. With $700 billion in T-bills, treasuries, those are IOUs. In effect, they gave us a loan. And we had, at one time, $6 trillion in T-bills out there. Every other country was paying our bills to maintain our lifestyles, for the armed forces, for our building projects. And Saudi Arabia's up at the top. China was the largest one, about $1.7 trillion. Now, China has been unloading those for a long time. So why would Obama not want to offend Saudi Arabia? A, first and foremost, because of how much money they buy in arms. It's well above $200 billion total. So you're looking at a lot of jobs, at a lot of insider beltway contacts, corporations, a lot of money, a lot of people who would not be able to live in those very high-end exclusive duplexes, townhouses in Washington and the surrounding suburbs. That's number one. Number two, has nothing to do with oil. We don't need any oil from Saudi Arabia. We can get all the oil we need from Canada, for example, and we're producing our own. But it has to do with all the crimes that we commit around the world. Do you realize if we take away their sovereignty, then that means we're open to other countries such as Syria and any other country that we've invaded, suing us for the damage we've done. After all, if these were not declarations of war, which they were not, and we went in and we destroyed civilian infrastructure, killed civilians, destroyed their buildings, their water structures, their electrical transformers, which we have done to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars to them, then suddenly we could start seeing massive amounts of lawsuits. Also, they could sue our troops for rape, for mutilation, for torture, and then sue the United States government for the fact that many of these black ops sites were run with and the knowledge and cooperation and training by CIA operatives. Thousands of people were arrested and tortured. They could sue us for that. In effect, we will likely be inundated with millions of people joining these class action lawsuits, as well they should. If we've committed these crimes, the United States government should be held accountable. And then it's on record. Then you have to think twice before you invade a country, before you do damage, before you engage in regime change, as we did in Libya, as we tried to do in Honduras, as we did in Honduras and tried to do in Venezuela. Then there could be a check that we have to pay for it. But also something that the media has not touched on, not a single member of the media, and that is, if it is shown, which thus far it is likely to prove, that Saudi Arabia was involved, and you don't have the top person, the top ambassador, who also is the head of their, now they are head of their intelligence division. You don't have people that tight into the royal court do something that everyone else is not aware of or approved. It's a very, very tightly controlled environment with an absolute monarchy. So that means that Saudi Arabia was behind the planning and execution of 9/11. That also means that they likely had co-conspirators in the United States, not just the 15 identified from Saudi Arabia, but others to pull this off. And that means that a lot of people could be held accountable. But also, think if we found out tomorrow that Iran, that China or Russia had planned and executed 9/11. The entire American public would be outraged and demanding retribution, cutting off all business with them, freezing their bank accounts and assets in the United States. But with Saudi Arabia, why are we not outraged by what we know thus far? And when those lawsuits start coming, if Saudi Arabia chooses not to engage the lawsuit, not to say we're above it, they'll go ahead and get verdicts. And once those verdicts are in, based upon the evidence that will be subpoenaed and the witnesses testifying, and you can believe that these lawyers are going to bring in all kinds of witnesses, then virtually the entire official report of 9/11 will be looked upon as trash, no better than the Warren Commission trash. It'll be dumped. And a new record of what happened will occur. How does that make all the people who were engaged, involved, or knew look? Their whole legacies be destroyed, including President Obama and the Clintons. Now, if they dump $700 billion, which I doubt because they're borrowing billions, they just floated a 10 and $5 and $10 billion bond, they're running deficits now. So if they gave us back $700 billion or sold it into the market, they could probably use the money. They could use the money right now. It would cause a massive crush to the dollar. And we'd probably lose about 10 to 15% value in the dollar overnight. And the stock market would virtually collapse. But it's already a giant bubble. It's probably, realistically, it should be about 6,000 to 7,000 instead of 18,000. So that correction is long overdue. So that is how I read this. Now let's see what plays out. I'm Gary Noll. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program.